Hello, ladies. Welcome to Women Words Wisdom, which is a podcast for women over 50 who want to challenge cultural narratives surrounding aging. Let's recognize and celebrate the raw truth behind what we wise women are learning and experiencing. My name is Robin Enright Salcedo, and I'm your host for the podcast. I believe we have a choice in how we face our aging. We can look at it with dread, or we can look at it with curiosity. If you believe that 60 is the new 40, this isn't the right podcast for you. Let's face this head on, and let's talk about the real issues. Let's find a way through it together. In 2010, I began what I thought at the time was my greatest life adventure, a move from Massachusetts to Boulder, Colorado at the age of 51. I loaded up my Subaru, bought my cockapoo, Tigger, a booster seat so he could see out the window, and I pointed my car west to begin my new life. While this was indeed a great life adventure, I've realized that the greatest adventure of my life was something I missed beginning altogether, my journey into older age and the many new doors that opened and new chapters that began. And while my drive to Colorado was meticulously mapped out, this adventure has not been. I'm a storyteller who uses the written word and photography to provide a glimpse of my subjects, so why not create a project that focuses on all the ways we end and begin again during this life phase? So I'm curious, who are you? What are you working on? Who and what inspires you? What royally pisses you off? What new chapters have you begun? I promise to be real with you. No bullshit. It's kind of scary, to be honest, but since I've always made sense of the universe through writing and allowing myself to be vulnerable, I guess I'm willing to risk it. Welcome to Woman Words Wisdom, the conversation episodes where I interview fascinating women over the age of 50. And today, I am delighted to introduce Esther Cohen. When I think of Esther, I think of two words, nourishment and healing. The foundation for Esther's philosophy is that nourishment is our primary healer. This philosophy grew out of childhood experiences and the journey she took to heal her body, mind, and spirit. Esther believes that our stories lie at the core of our beliefs, and through their unraveling, we come to know who we are and who we are not. Through Esther's over 30-year journey as a health, nutrition, and energy practitioner and teacher, she has gained a body of wisdom based on her observations of these clients and what she knows to be true of nature as the primary healer. From this deep exploration with her clients, discovering what makes us sick and how we heal, Esther has launched Nourishing Destiny, a program which teaches people from all walks of life to observe, embody, and be curious about what it is to be human and thriving. Giving practices, outlooks, and structure to how we can be active participants in our own health and healing. Esther is also the author of Alchemy of Nourishment, The Art, Science, and Magic of Eating, and you can learn more about Esther and her work at alchemyofnourishment.com, which will be in the show notes. Welcome, Esther!
Hi, thank you.
So good to see you today on this chilly, chilly Thursday morning in Colorado. Before we get started, or as we get started, there's so much, as we were mentioning before I started recording, that you have such a wealth of knowledge. And I was joking with Esther that I feel like I'm, you know, interviewing Steve Jobs, who has such vast knowledge, and where do you even begin, you know? So I was thinking that one of the first things I'd like before we learn, we dive into the work that you do today and the value you can provide, is how did your work come to be? What is the background for why you are doing what you're doing today, which I often find is even more fascinating than what people are doing?
Well, I think, of course, it grew out of my own childhood and just that kind of innate desire in me. I grew up in the South, and I was the youngest of three children. But there was a good spread between my brother and sister, who were 8 and 10 years older than me. And so I had an older mom and a much older father at that time. And I just never felt like I belonged. And so I really spent my life searching for why am I here? And how can I feel comfortable here? And at a very early age, I began to cook. And it's just something that I was born with. My mother was not a great cook. It's not like it was handed down to me. It was kind of a survival orientation. Good. And I just loved it. It was my creative palette, really, and the way to take care of myself.
It's so fascinating that you get, first of all, there's hope for my children because I was a horrible cook. I hated cooking. I actually just started to enjoy cooking. So it's really interesting to see that that's where you found comfort, was in preparing food at a young age, because it could have gone another direction, the way we approach food as women. So do you remember what it was that that led you to food, as you know, preparing food and being curious about food and cooking? Was there any role model, or was it, you know, how?
I have to be, you know, I don't want to be socially incorrect here, but I grew up in the South in the 1960s, right, during the civil rights movement. And my family did have a black maid. Mm-hmm. And I must say, she was my second mother. And in many ways, my first mother, because I spent the majority of my time with her. And mm-hmm. thank God, because, oh my gosh, she saved my life. She was such a nourishing, solid figure in my life. Mm-hmm. And she would make me the most fabulous food. And, you know, of course, now nutritionally, I know it wasn't, you know, that mm-hmm. great for me, but it nourished my heart. Mm-hmm. And it made me feel loved. And so I think that was where I really started to connect with food as love, and what that meant.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
But what I was going to say is, it wasn't just the physical food. It was her standing in the kitchen and singing gospel, mm-hmm. and her just overwhelming reassurance of what a good and special person I was. Mm-hmm. And that's what really fed me. And I think that's what, when I went through all of my difficulties growing up, that's what I could come back to.
It's fascinating. You know, I never even thought of food in that way. Cause you know, like you, my mom was not a cook, and we didn't have, when I was very young, money was scarce. So food, it tended to be like pasta with ragu sauce. I mean, which I, today though, is my comfort food, not that sauce, but pasta, that is my comfort food. But when I converted to Judaism in, oh gosh, what year was it? 1991. And finding my own way, he's now my ex-husband, but his family, you know, obviously we're all born and raised as Jewish, in the Jewish tradition. And I couldn't find a way to be myself within Judaism. So I started cooking, creating my own recipes for Passover. And I learned something, that it wasn't about the food. There was something about the act of the preparation. So what you're talking about, and the connection, the way I was able to connect to Judaism in my own way, came through food. So the idea that this is something that you found so much comfort in at a young age, and started to, well, you've built quite a career around this, as well as, I don't even like calling what you do a career, because it seems you're a healer. So it seems, you know, it seems to kind of downplay it a little bit, but the fact that you had that woman in your life giving you comfort that way is such an interesting way to look at what we put in our bodies. you know?
Right. And I grew up Jewish as well. Uh-huh. And what I loved were the celebrations for the Jewish holidays, for Passover. Mm-hmm. And it really imbued in me that sense of connection, mm-hmm. and the importance of that, and ritual, which mm-hmm. I also love, because I feel like that especially eating is such a sacred act, mm-hmm. that, and of course, growing up in the time I did, we had a lot of TV dinners. That was the great thing. And, mm-hmm. and chicken pot pies, and, you know, everything was fast. And my family didn't have a lot of money then either. And so we had a lot of peanut butter and a lot of tuna fish.
Yep.
And for many years, I refused to eat either. They weren't comforting to me. Fried chicken was, but not tuna fish. And it just, I cooked for my friends really early on. I was always making homemade pizzas and barbecued chicken. And it was just my way of connecting and sharing and offering love.
It sounds like it was a very powerful, a powerful overriding principle in your life. How did you take that, it sounds like not only were you receiving comfort at a young age, but then as you were developing and making pizzas for your friends and all that, you were also providing nourishment and comfort. How did these things, can you lead us a little bit through your journey into where you are today? How did you begin to learn more? How did you, you know, what was your process?
Well, honestly, I had a very, very challenging and difficult childhood. My father passed away when I was 14, and I was very close to him. And Catherine, the woman who raised me, she left at that time. So I felt very alone, mm-hmm. and had a lot of challenges in terms of connecting with people. I felt very insecure. And like many preteens and teenagers, I had a lot of body image issues. And so I kind of went through, oh gosh, every diet around, from drinking apple cider vinegar until mm-hmm. my stomach was burning, and the broccoli diet until I had this very strange odor from the cruciferous vegetable. Friends really didn't want to be around me. And, you know, all in the glory to lose probably 5 pounds, mm-hmm. right? And I just felt very insecure and didn't feel like I fit in mm-hmm. anywhere. So I left home very early, kind of determined to honestly either get myself together, or that I thought maybe I would, you know, take my life. Mm-hmm. Like, it was a severe struggle.
Yeah.
So I don't want to minimize it. And, you know, I do think we all have disordered eating tendencies. Mm-hmm. And just as women, it's kind of genetically passed down to us as a trauma. And so I went many, many, many miles away from home, kind of in search of finding me. And what always went with me, and the way I supported myself, was to cook for others.
When you talk about, I think you know, clearly, you know, what is it that causes us as women, you know, you talk about it's trauma passed down, because I know, you know, when I think I told you when we had our initial conversation as an adult, I mean, gosh, probably just 10 years ago, I mean, pretty 40s and 50s, I started to learn that I would say a good 80% of women I know have definitely struggled with disordered eating in some way. And then there's, you know, the other percentage, and I include myself in that, of the body image as we, you know, I look back now at what I looked like, you know, when I was 10 years ago, and I'm like, oh my goodness, look at that little body. But at the time I didn't feel, you know what I, so what do you, you know, what has your experience taught you about how we do view the process of eating and body nourishment as women, and why does it get so off the rails?
Well, energetically for the past at least 500 years or more, women have been really looked at for, you know, how they appear, what's their appearance. And, you know, coming out of, honestly, the church and different religious orders, there was a high value put on young girls looking very angelic, mm-hmm. and being very thin. And so their mothers didn't feed them to keep them from having their periods, mm-hmm. and to keep them, you know, so they would be, recipients of the good of the church, right? Mm-hmm. And many of these daughters died, which was also kind of a part of even the great honor, the sacrifice.
Right.
And so we really, it became, you know, what I call the morphic field, that energetic presence that to have weight on us was ungodlike.
And it was...
Yeah. And so it became a sign of being out of control, of being a undisciplined female, to have a body that was robust.
Right.
You know.
And it seems like we consider ourselves so enlightened, but I would have to argue that hasn't really left our culture, at least here in the United States. Perhaps, in other countries, there's a little bit less emphasis on that. I'm not certain. I'm not an anthropologist. I don't really know. But what you're talking about is really fascinating. There was a woman I mentioned right before we started recording that I had interviewed about who had had breast cancer and opted, she had a double mastectomy, opted to not go through reconstruction. And in research for my conversation with her, if you go through art through the periods, most of the time, and this I'm mostly focusing on breasts, but I bet weight would be in there too. If you were Rubenesque, shall we say, you were considered loose or, vulgar, or, you know, that there, you know, it was the slimmer and the, smaller breasted and, all tiny waist, all of that was what was considered pure. So that it's reflected in our art history as well.
Right. Well, there's, you know, also reflected in that art history is that you can look through all the great museums and go back in history and the great artists, and you will see hundreds of self-portraits of men. Huh. And you can see very, very few, like 10 compared to 250 in the Metropolitan Museum, mm-hmm. of women. Okay, because it was really considered vain, mm-hmm. and not pure. And women didn't have that self-image. And what I mean by that strong sense of authenticity, that what I call, you know, with the autoimmune, we have it just rampant in our culture because we don't have a strong immune system, which is really based on self-worth. And so... that's when I say ancestral trauma, that's what's been handed down to us. And so even in the women's movement, you know, we'll say 40 years ago, what women did to get freedom was to look like a man, to dress like a man, mm-hmm. and take on those masculine qualities. And I spent 10 years working in women's recovery and eating disorders and Boulder Community Hospital, as well as Kaiser, and working with so many women, I mean, from unfortunate ages of 10 and 11 up to women in their 70s.
Wow.
And it's really just fascinating how much we have deprived ourselves of what nourishes us and made it an external reflection, as opposed to what do we really love and desire, mm-hmm. and what's yummy. we've given our authority over to external voices.
You are just tapping into I feel like you're talking one in one way, shape, or form to almost every woman I know, and that who are, even if it's not related, you know, directly to eating, the sense of nourishment definitely plays in, but who cannot find their own inner self value is the word. And the mirror that we look at isn't the one that reflects us. You know, we're not looking at ourselves. We're looking externally to, you know, whether it's our partners, our families, our friends, the people we see on the street and in the soup, instead of directly being able to see what you just said, who we really are, and to value that in a way that nourishes ourselves. When you have worked with, that's got to have been very challenging work that you did. How do you, you know, is there a pronged approach to that? Is, you know, how do you, because obviously so much of that has to do with how we think.
Exactly. It's all about the psychology of, you can call it the psychology of eating. I call it the psychology of nourishment. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I think as women, we were raised to be selfless. And mm-hmm. this word selfish is very, you know, it's really charged. Mm-hmm. To say, well, I'm going to, what does mm-hmm. my soul need mm-hmm. and desire? You know, so I can really express who I am and own my feelings. And so it is extremely difficult and very, very sad to see how it, you know, permeates our culture, to see so many young women, you know, really killing themselves literally to meet a particular external standard.
And the standard isn't necessarily a real standard anyway. I mean, there's one thing that's always been fascinating to me, is often the things we think are so, I mean, as you know, I work as a photographer, and one of the questions I've started asking women in particular when I do intake is there anything about yourself that you're uncomfortable with? And I don't remember exactly how I phrased that, but the reason is I've taken pictures of women that I think are so lovely. I mean, that they, to me, they're all beautiful. I mean, every woman that I capture in a photograph, I feel a sense of blessing and honor that I am able to do that and hopefully show them some of the beauty I do see. But I have had many opportunities with the women I work with, and the majority of whom are over 50, that will tell me something that they really don't like about their external body. And I will tell you, I didn't even notice it. I didn't, you know, it didn't even factor in. So that's what I mean when I say, you know, we have embodied so much external information. And I'm wondering if that external information is even reality, because
absolutely not. And in fact, I love that you just used that word, because I was going to bring it back to embodiment, because you said to be enlightened. And I think really, you know, we've done this spiritual bypass for so many years where we're thinking we're going to give up, you know, our self to, mm-hmm. you know, for something greater, to connect with God, you know, when we leave this life. And what I think that enlightenment is embodiment, where we are really deeply in touch with our physicality, who we are, how it feels to have those emotions move through us, you know, really, because that's our humanity. That's really touches, you know, who we are, and allows us that incredible journey and discovery. Mm-hmm. Of getting to know it, but we've become so disembodied that we've given our, you know, our authority over to what we see and think others want. And what I love about, you know, what I use, because I do have a background in nutrition and science, and I'm a bit of a geek that way. And I really love merging the world of energy and a metaphor with the science, because it's just this wonderful mirror, mm-hmm. you know, that we're really just fractals of our experience. And so what I wanted to say is that a lot of my work is about embodiment. How does it feel to be you? Because people come into me often and they say, I read about this diet. You know, what do you think of the keto diet? What do you think of the paleo diet? And on and on. And I'm like, we do not eat with our brain. We eat with our body. What is your experience when you eat that food? Mm-hmm. How does it feel in you? Does it feel empty? Are you excited to come to that next meal? You know, yep. How do you feel when you go outside and you stand in this incredible scenery and see a beautiful mountain? Mm-hmm. You know, do you really, you know, inhale that? Do you eat it vigorously? Mm-hmm. Does that impression, you know, stay with you, mm-hmm. not just on your camera? And a good meal is the same way, because we don't eat with our heads.
It's interesting. I know we, you know, I mentioned to Esther that I had recently started Weight Watchers program, and you groaned a little bit, and I want to hear a little bit about that. But one of the, when I was seeing my physician, she mirrored a bit about what you just said, was because she said, please don't try any of those fad diets, the paleo, doesn't have the skill in terms of passing on information as you do. But what I got out of it was more like, I am not, what you just said is so true. I am moving through my life, putting things in my mouth. I can't say celebratory or that I see, you know, a beautiful mountain and scenery and take it in. But what I can say is where I am now, and I'm only 6 weeks into eating a little bit differently for me, I do feel nourished in the sense that I have made decisions for me, and I'm eating food that makes me feel happy. And if I want pasta, I'm going to eat pasta. If I want, you know, it's not about no, no, don't do, don't do, don't do. For me, what I took out of what I'm doing right now is being mindful. That's probably the best word, you know. Of course, I wanted to lose a few pounds, but it was also, I want to be healthy, and I was not feeling healthy. So it seems like what you're, I'm a novice. I don't know, you know, I don't know what I embody and what I don't. I don't know what stories I truly am telling myself, although I've probably had more therapy than most people of my age. And it's all been extremely beneficial every second to get to know myself. But I think this is one of the things that was so intriguing to me about you is your approach. It's, and in your book, we're not talking about a diet plan in there. It's an entire body, mind, spiritual experience that you are offering. It doesn't, you know, I love how that book is written. When did you write that book? I didn't even.
Oh, well, it finally got published. Oh, 2.5 years ago?
Because it's lovely. It's, I mean, I have not read it from cover to cover. But I love, it's almost to me like you're, you know what? I'm not going to say what it is almost like to me. Tell me how that book came to be and what your hope was with that book.
Well, the book really came to be out of a number of years ago. I had a graduate level school, 3-year program master's level certification program. And the school is called Seven Bowls School of Nutrition, Nourishment, and Healing. And honestly, I had hired someone to teach a detoxification class. I was kind of very ignorant and even opposed to the word detoxify. Why should we have to detoxify? And in full disclosure, he was a terrible teacher. The students didn't like him. And he's the only faculty that I ever let go of. Wow. And so I had to teach the class. Mm-hmm. So in my typical approach, it was like, okay, now I've got to learn everything about it. And because I believe food is medicine, it was like, how am I going to take this information of how the body detoxifies and what that means and put it into something that's more of a hands-on daily practice, mm-hmm. without it being, a medical prescription, so mm-hmm. to speak. And in my exploration, one of the most fascinating things that I came upon was the origins of the word diet comes from the Greek word dietia. And what it means is way of life.
Huh, interesting.
And every species on this planet has a very specific diet, except for human beings and cats and dogs.
Interesting.
Because we feed them. Like the deer eat what a deer eats. And a deer doesn't think, should I eat this? Should I not eat this? Oh, right. I'm not gonna have some grass today. Right. Oh, just not up for that particular prairie. And but we do, mm-hmm. right? And we put a lot of emotional content mm-hmm. into what that is. And so that's really in wanting to teach, I was also teaching the energetics of food. So beyond the nutrients and the nutritional value your carrot has, it grows deep into the ground and it's full of sugars. It's a root. Mm-hmm. And so that energy that it gives you is energy that comes in and down, right?
Right.
And so it's not just, that it has beta carotene and blah, de blah. It helps you feel that sense of coherence and groundedness.
Okay.
And the color is very mm-hmm. bright and vibrant. And that also resonates with your cells. So as we learn to eat, that's what I mean. It really took me to, everything is food and everything is nourishment. And I just kind of, in that book, I had the wonderful opportunity when I did get my master's in nutrition of spending 6 months on the Navajo reservation, because I've always been into culture and cuisine, and really understanding their habits and how their culture and how the influence of our culture had changed and shaped their culture. And it was all through food, through diet, that we took away their indigenous diet and they became very sick. They became obese. And when I was working at the Indian hospital, 80% of the women who came through had their gallbladders removed.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is that from diet? That's
all from diet. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Energetically, the gallbladder is about taking risk. Mm-hmm. Is about, being able to, step out, have the gall uh-huh. for yourself. And their gall was diminished over so many decades.
Wow.
And so it very much affected my whole psychology mm-hmm. and experience around eating. I went to a traditional Thanksgiving ceremony with my Navajo family that I became very close to. And of course their Thanksgiving is very different than ours, but it is filled with gratitude. And I was so excited I was going to go cook with the family. And much to my shock, the food that we were having was, these green jello with mini marshmallows and Kool-Aid and mutton and, these pre-baked biscuits. And I was also pregnant at the time. And so I was extremely freaked out.
Yeah.
What was I going to do? I was like, I can't eat this food. This food is terrible. I was a vegetarian. You know, I had all these ideas about me and diet and food. And we sat down. I was the only white person at this huge family dinner. And they said the blessings and really thanking Mother Earth and so much gratitude for this food. And I was in tears by the end of the blessing. And I thought, what an arrogant idiot. I'm going to eat this food. And I can't tell you how fabulous it tasted and how, oh my gosh, how good I felt.
So it's interesting that you say that. Was it their ability to be grateful? Was it being a part of that community? If you had to tease out the elements that made you feel that way, do you know what they meant?
It was absolutely that I was part of their family, mm-hmm. that no matter how much had been taken away from them, how poorly this processed food was, this was not the food of their culture.
Right.
But they were grateful.
It's
sincerely grateful. They weren't sitting at Thanksgiving and thinking about, you know, how we've tried to exterminate them. They were just loving their family. And they took me in as a sister.
Do you find, a little bit off topic, but do you find that in today's, we just celebrated Thanksgiving, we're coming into more winter holiday season. Do you find, or have you in your circle seen that people seem a little bit more grateful right now, or do you feel, I'm kind of putting you on the spot with this question. I mean, I know how I feel, which is a sense of gratitude I've never felt before. I've never been conscious of. I shouldn't say I've never felt it. Every day feels like a gift to me right now. So it's much easier to touch gratitude. I feel like in the before time, I wasn't conscious. I don't know if I'm actually saying this right, but I'm feeling very much as if I'm paying more attention, mm-hmm. if that's perhaps what's going on. And I don't know that if I'm an aberration or not, because I spend 24/7 inside my studio. So I'm just curious with people, because you do, I mean, that's one of the things when I was going through your book, I liked the section talking about gratitude and just, I liked how that book, you know, I think when I first started talking to you, I was thinking, oh, eating cleanses, yeah. And then I realized that's not at all what we're talking about here, which is, as we've said, we've used the word quite a few times, that word nourishment. Do you think people are a little bit better at nourishing themselves right now? Or do you think maybe that's not happening?
Well, I do. I think that that's the silver lining of this difficult time, that it has forced us to slow down. It's forced us to be with ourselves. And I think that the beautiful awarenesses that we're starting to have and appreciation. I appreciate this day. There's also this incredible curiosity and mystery, because every day it's like, who knows what's going to happen that day?
Yeah.
And you know, pre-COVID, I guess we'll call it PC or BC before COVID. We weren't stopped enough to appreciate it, to take it in, to like, oh my gosh, it feels so good to talk to this friend today. Mm-hmm. And or to be with my pet. I know for myself, I'm very fortunate. I live in this beautiful wilderness area. Mm-hmm. And so I have the appreciation of really the skies are cleaner, the air is clearer, and the animals are more present.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so I feel that sense, like you shared, of waking up and just being grateful to have the life that I have. Mm-hmm. And it gives me more capacity to pivot. That's been my word this year, because everything I've planned has had to change.
Yeah, you've had, because you were close to those fires too in Colorado, weren't you? I mean, you were.
Absolutely. We had our house in our truck and our car for a week. We first had a fire to the north of us, the Cameron Peak fire. And we moved all of our stuff to a house, you know, a mile or two down the road. Mm-hmm. And then the next day, the the other one that was
there were so many.
I know, the other one that was very near Boulder.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
the Cowood fire.
Yeah. Yeah.
Broke out, and then that, and so we could literally see the flames on both sides. We went down and put all of our belongings back in the truck and car, brought them back up to us, and then the Troublesome fire broke out, which was to the west of us. So we were at three fires all around us. And, you know, to tell you the truth, it was like, wow, really start to know what matters to you. And we had all this stuff in our cars, and we still haven't fully unpacked it and put it back. But there's this sense of, I want to get rid of what I don't have and pay it forward, give it to other people. Mm-hmm. I don't need so many things, and like just feeling so much appreciation mm-hmm. for the connections, both with people and with the natural world.
It is. I think you're right. It is whatever you want to call it, a silver lining. But you said something earlier that really, I think, is so key to this space. And then I want to hear more about how you work with people. But and you use the word stop. We weren't stopped as much. And that's something that I have particularly become conscious of, that there was always a go from here to there, to there, to there. And life has taken on a different, you use the word pivot too. It's taken on such a different, just a different energy that I do find, and I'm usually pretty good when I deal with service people, but I find now that I have to make eye contact. It's almost like I'm drowning for that. You know, I need, and I'm introverted, but I need to look at people. And that to me is a stop. It's not about, oh, what do I buy here? And do I have enough money? It's totally about, who am I in front of? And that's just a different experience for me. And that to me feels a lot like gratitude. I'm very conscious of human beings around me and the pain, the collective pain that I'm sensing from others, but then also the pivot. I mean, every plan I think many of us have made this year has changed. And it's, I think in some ways for me, it's been good for me because I'm a planner. I know what I'm doing next week and the week after. You know, I like to plan my work. I like to have a schedule, but not, I mean, I'm an artist, so I'm kind of flowing all over the place, but I like to know if I'm going to go see my children. And now I know that I can make these plans, but I have to, in the back of my head, say, they may just need to change, Robin. They just may need to change, and it's not the end of the world. I think, you know, especially those experiences that you have too, especially that you've had this year with all of those fires. Because one thing for people who are listening, it's not just the flames that you're seeing in the distance. We in Colorado, most of us couldn't even go outside. I mean, the air quality was so horrible, so terrible, and so bad for you. I have asthma, I was nowhere near the fires that Esther was. So there were the safety. The feelings of safety and uncertainty, along with this feeling of being completely trapped indoors when we're a nature-oriented community, is really challenging. So How did you nourish yourself during that time period? How do you nourish Esther?
Well, like you said, it was very difficult to go outside, which is probably one of my most loved ways of nourishing myself, and that wasn't really possible. And dancing is a big aspect of nourishing myself. And that's because when I'm dancing, and I, for a little while, been doing what's called five rhythms from Gabrielle Roth's orientation, but really aware of kind of what emotions are going through me and allowing them permission to arise and move through them and kind of get into them, with whether it's the fury of feeling, you know, boxed in and anger, or rather it's just the joy of the stillness, the yeah. joy of the kind of the not knowing mm-hmm. and moving into that. And it really brought a great appreciation, you know, for life, for everything around me. And oh my gosh, when the skies finally cleared, it was like crying, because it was like, wow, yes, we can see again. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think of that with the masks. I have that same feeling. We have a lot of deliveries that come up to our house, and I'm like having these wonderful conversations with all of the delivery people, because there's just so much appreciation, mm-hmm. you know, that A, there's some contact, and B, they're bringing something that I need, and mm-hmm. they're, you know, out doing this work. And I think it's really bringing us down to what really matters, mm-hmm. that connection and community. And I remember saying a number of months ago, actually, to a couple of friends of mine, like, it's going to be really interesting when our masks come off. Yeah. And I don't mean, okay, so now we can be ourselves, but this real hope that we will like let down these false personas that we all hold, kind of back to the very first mm-hmm. aspect of what we were talking about, that we can be more authentic. And we can take that moment mm-hmm. to really look at each other and go, wow, we are on this planet together. And instead of this feeling that we have now, which is so divisive, mm-hmm. like my way is the right way, that, you know, your way is your way. And how beautiful if you do you and I do me, we'll be fabulous. I don't need to control you.
Right.
And don't control me. And so I think we're really at this fabulous, you know, in I work as an intuitive, mm-hmm. and I've been very aware of, how can I say, the planetary shift of energy that we are moving in. And, you know, mm-hmm. we can call it the age of Aquarius if you follow astrology, but we're truly moving out of the kind of materialistic, scientific, industrial age, which has been an age of competition and separation. Mm-hmm. And we're moving into a more nurturing age. It's required if we're going to evolve as humans, mm-hmm. that we're not really competing with one another again, but we're cooperating, and we're living in community, and that sense of, I need you, mm-hmm. and you need me.
It's so... when you get it, I just wrote about an experience I had in Ghana and the Ghanaian women, and everything you just said is what I so envy with them within their tribes, within their villages, the community of women and the nurturing of one another. And I agree with you. We have to find a way to come together and nurture. What was happening before wasn't working. And you, being a woman of a certain age like me, we all know that we move through horrible things and we come out on the other end. And while we would never want to go through those horrible things, there is something that comes out often on the other end that you say, oh my goodness, thank goodness I had that horrible experience. We're coming, I know we're coming close to having been talking for a while. I could actually talk to you all day because your amazing wealth of knowledge. I love your spiritual views. Views aren't your beliefs, your philosophy, your life philosophy. Who comes to you to work with you? Who tends to seek you out, and how do you interact with? I know you teach classes. I know you do some prenatal work, and tell us a little bit about how you work, because I think we've talked so much about what brought you here and what your belief system is, which is incredibly powerful. Can you share a little bit of the, you know, how Esther does her magic?
Well, I think what you were just talking about is a beautiful way to lead into it, because we're so made up of experiences, right? And it's really those experiences, those traumas, those memories, they are held within our cellular body, mm-hmm. right? And they're often our unconscious mind runs our conscious mind 90% of the time, right? And those are those active memories and those traumas that we've had. And so in my work, I'm looking at when someone comes to me with a great deal of issues and symptomology, you know, physical symptoms, expressions in the body. What my exploration is where are we going to go back to those formative beliefs? Also, beliefs are handed down, just like DNA, where I have green eyes and brown hair. My ancestral beliefs are handed down. And so that's why I call the word alchemy of nourishment, because it alchemizes those experiences, make us who we are. Mm-hmm. But what we're doing is unwinding them so they are no longer our habitual go-to.
Okay.
We're completely unaware of. And I love that you had said, well, now you're feeling more aware of different aspects of your life. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where it starts. And so I feel like I act as a guide. Mm-hmm. And so I have the nutritional science. I'm a functional nutritionist, but I really love understanding our body's voice, mm-hmm. bringing that wisdom to the surface, because our symptoms are just our soul screaming for our attention. And it's not like you're a bad person, you have this or that. It's like, here, let me give you this information, because this has been going on for years and years. And we all have the capacity to shift that and change ourselves.
Right.
We are not stagnant. We are not stuck. And so what I love about the pivoting this year is it's really strengthening that muscle of adaptability. Mm-hmm. Oh, this isn't working. I can do that without identification, mm-hmm. you know, in there.
It's, I think what you're, if someone said, well, who exactly is Esther? That's a guide, spiritual guide sound. I mean, I don't like it to sound too woo-woo, because you have such incredible concrete knowledge and uses for that. But it's really interesting, because we do talk about, and I'm a big believer in, when I go to a physician, if I have an issue, I'm always seeking the physician that looks at my whole body and my life. Not just, oh, you have a shoulder injury, you know, your shoulder is doing this, or your neck is tight. More of a, I love people, healers, that are able to say, what's going on in your life right now? And I've always found some connection. I'm not saying there isn't a physical reason, like maybe I fell on my shoulder, but there's always a connection. And it seems to me that what you are able to do is exactly what you just said, is take all those clues and all those the things we might be experiencing in an external way and help us go back inward and understand how that is, how who we are is manifesting how we feel, maybe?
Exactly. Well, it's honestly who we aren't is manifesting how we feel. And yes, I love that orientation of being a spiritual guide, because it really is the healing of the spirit. Mm-hmm. And that comes down into our physical form. And, you know, I think it's interesting that you said, well, maybe I fell on my shoulder. And my curiosity is, why did you fall on your shoulder? Right? Like that's, you know, I have so many clients who come in and say, oh, I have multiple head injuries. Well, I'm like, okay, what does that mean? You know, that our body has so much consciousness and wisdom. We're not mechanical whatsoever. And we use what, 10% of our capacity.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, what if we had 15% of our capacity? You know, how vibrant and vital will we be? And that doesn't mean we don't get information. Oh, like my knee's hurting. And I'm like, okay, well, I know what my knees are about. Knees are about adaptability. Mm-hmm. That's the consciousness they hold, right? And I'm like, okay, where am I being too rigid in mm-hmm. my thinking or my wanting or whatever it is? And so it's really using the psychology of symptoms, or just that our bodies really desire to be balanced. And we know how to do it.
You just blew my mind, because my knees have been bothering me since this started. And I can very easily identify areas I've been too rigid. That's just fascinating. That's really fun. And I think it's, do you, as we come to a conclusion, are there other cultures that are better at this than us as Americans? Because I often do, I love to look at, you know, one of my favorite places in the world is Italy. And one of the reasons I love Italy is the first time I went there, I loved how I would sit down to dinner and 2 hours later get up. Meals were church. You know, it was,
absolutely.
You really relished each taste. I mean, I love Italian food anyway, and I love wine, but it was the whole experience of dining and the relaxation and all of that. So I'm just curious about how, are there cultures that you have encountered or that you're aware of that seem to be a little bit better at understanding this feeling, how we embody falsehoods perhaps, or trauma from the past, and know that it's very important to move outside of that to gain more wisdom about how we're taking care of ourselves?
Absolutely. You can look at the blue zones. These are the cultures that live to centenarians. They live over 100 years old. And they do not dwell in the stories mm-hmm. of their ancestors. They don't dwell in what wasn't right. And they thrive because exactly what you said, they take the time to enjoy their meals, to enjoy their family, to be connected. Uh-huh. And we can also look at the indigenous cultures. And their reason for extinction is more due to Western civilization mm-hmm. because they had such an understanding that they were a part of nature. They were not here to dominate nature. So they took their information. If the day was cloudy and an eagle flew by them, that was information mm-hmm. as guidance. And we ignore so much of what goes on in our world because we have a particular goal and focus. And it's not that it's wrong to be focused, but we do so at the at the extinction of everything right. else, right? And And so it's bringing that fullness back into our experience. So again, we're eating life, and we're not separate from it, as we've become so separate and so narrow in what we are willing to take in.
I love that, and I love what you said about people who don't dwell in, you know, the what was. And I feel, as a human being, I know I fight that at times. I'm still thinking about something that happened, you know, that wasn't fair, and suddenly realize, Robin, you've got to let, it's time to let go. I think often we are aware that we need to let go of things or even gain more knowledge about that, but we're not so good at trying to understand how to do that. And it sounds like you are the person that might be the right guide for getting there.
Well, thank you. I do like to believe that is what my work is about, is helping us gain what I call the five stages of transformation, which is awareness, acceptance, that beautiful part of, yeah, this is me and that's me.
Right.
And understanding, yes, all these pieces that came together. And, you know, almost like our patterns are our loyal soldiers. It kept us, allowed us to survive to get to where we are, but we don't need that anymore. Then being able to resolve it, you know, that forgiveness mm-hmm. and resolution, and then action. How are you going to move forward in a new way? So that story no longer is the guide point backwards, because that's backwards. And, you know, how can we open up to some fresh new possibility? And, you know, in medicine, there's the placebo effect, and the placebo effect is like 75% effective. That's huge.
Wow.
And there's very few drugs that have that kind of efficacy.
Right.
Right. And that means if you believe it, it happens. That's spontaneous change, spontaneous healing. And so I like to think of myself as a cheerleader, even more than a guide. I'm like, yay, you. Because it's so beautiful to see that alchemy, that shift, and step out of that story, which, yes, we want to honor it, but ultimately it's a story. It's our mind's remembrance. Mm-hmm. It's not the truth. It is a truth for you. And being able to let go, like you said, you know, I just need to let go of that. Well, that's kind of one of the most difficult things for all of us to do. And how do we do that? How do we honor, acknowledge, and be able to go, oh, and thank you, I don't need this anymore.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn and choose another perspective to orient towards.
And it is, I think, from what you say, you know, what you're saying too is true. The first step is the awareness of that. You know, I have had my own past traumas that I've, you know, explored with therapists, and I will say, still, you know, the very awareness that something, that there is a story there, is huge, because you start to understand, oh, I am feeling this probably not because of today. It's not because of right now. It's that body memory. It's that I'm reading
active memory, because it activates. It was never fully digested and released from the body like we do a meal, right? Uh-huh. And so it's stuck there. So what happens is you're in a situation and your amygdala immediately goes to that experience that's been stuck. And so you perceive this conversation as if you were 3 years old and what went on then is happening now. And you are in it way before you have any opportunity to change it. And not only that, it's like, absolutely, that's what's happening.
Yes.
And so they're like, whoa, okay, let's slow this down. You know, wow, that's what's going on. And we're so quick to judge and criticize ourselves, you know, that when we kind of take that cloak off, gives us a lot more opportunity for expansion and possibility.
And that. it's a scary cloak to take off at right. first.
Yeah, absolutely. And that too is a concept, mm-hmm. right? That as we start to move through these things, it's like, it's not so scary. I like to think that if you and I were looking at a tree, there's uh-huh. about 20% of that tree that we would agree on and describe. Oh, it's got green leaves and yada, yada. But there's 80% that you see that's absolutely unique.
Right.
And 80% that I see that's unique. So what that is there's this 360 degrees of possibility and perspective. Right. Right. And let's just take a different, I'm just going to turn a little bit and see what that other perspective might be. And I think that's where, when I speak of rigidity, we've become so tight in our perception rather than to go, okay, that's true. And what else is true?
Yes. Right. And what you said is so true too. When I say taking the cloak, it's that initial like, okay. But as a writer, I can say, I think this is along the lines of what we're talking about. When I write from a place of truth, as I see it, and vulnerability, and as a way of sharing, I am shocked by how many people I actually connect with. Even if I was I'm often terrified, like, oh, people are going to think I'm weird here, but here goes.
and they love it.
And they do, because they have it in themselves too. I mean, it allows for that connection. I do, I know there was, we did want to talk about, as we conclude, I do want to give you an opportunity to talk about what you are working on right now, and to also open the door that maybe we might want to have a chapter two of this conversation at some point in the future. Because I honestly do feel we are just touching the surface of the many gifts you have to offer, and what is happening in that brilliant brain of yours. But as we conclude, I do want to, as we conclude for today, just give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about where you are right now.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much. And yes, I have two big projects that I'm working on right now. And the first is my teaching project, and it's called Nourishing Destiny. And they're standalone modules, but I really want to teach what I do, what I know, so that people can take a greater understanding. You know, I would say it's medicine of the future, but it's not. It's medicine that's here right now. So we understand these vibrational frequencies that become these beliefs and stories and limiting constructs for us. And so we really can understand how they operate, mm-hmm. how they infuse our consciousness and our actions, and how to shift those. You know, so we look at everything from the psycho-neuro-immunology, our energetic biology, and merging that with that physical expression, and learning these tools to empower you to move into your authentic self, your soul's work, and greater expression.
This teaching is available to just an average person. And how are you, what is the delivery of this, and how would people learn more?
People can learn more by going to my website.
Okay.
And it's under Nourishing Destiny and classes. And it's, of course, these days on Zoom. Mm-hmm. If you are in the area, and we've been in a bit of a pod, then some people come in person, mm-hmm. Obviously in the future when that's possible, because there's so much in the direct transmission that's wonderful. But we have people in the class from all over the world.
Wow.
So, It's really a great opportunity. It's very intimate, and it's an opportunity for real personal evolution.
Okay.
As well as tools and practices that you can take into your work.
Okay.
Whatever that is, whether you're a therapist or a photographer, it's going to really increase and enhance that creativity and expression. There's also a certification for those who wish that, who go through all of the different modules, so that you can be a healing guide. You can really add that in. I do work one-on-one clients.
Okay.
And I will say that I tend to get a lot of clients who have those difficult illnesses that Western science can't get a name on or a handle on. Mm-hmm. And I've worked with, I've had the honor of working with numerous cancers and difficult situations physically. And so it is both a physical and spiritual healing. Mm-hmm. And then the my soul's work is I want to detoxify the children of marginalized communities so they have capacity for self-agency and to have vital, full lives. And I was really motivated. This began back at the Flint water crisis, and that no one was going in and doing anything to heal the situation. They were just putting money on top of it, because these lives will be dysfunctional. They won't have the brain development that
right.
you and I have had. And this can be done nutritionally,
right?
And in a way that can bring community together and support the arts and agency. And so that is, I call that community supported nourishment through my nonprofit, which is the Nourishment Education Foundation.
You're a busy woman.
I am busy. And that I'm hoping to launch, after COVID. So I'm really getting everything designed now to be able to do that and, launch it in 2022 when we're really out of this particular COVID era.
Well, you are a gift to our world and our culture, a healing gift. I want to ask you one final question, and that is, what is the one thing many of the women that are listening today, and they are over 50, they're from all varieties and walks of life, if you could give one sentence of inspiration or encouragement, or I don't even know, whatever, something positive, obviously, what might it be?
Well, that we are really needed. We are the sages. We are the crones that this world needs. They need our wisdom. They need our insight and experience, that we're full of riches. And to honor this time in life, I know it's a struggle for us because we don't look 30 and maybe we don't feel that way either, but we can. And I want to really encourage that we need our sisterhood. And and in doing so, we're going to give a great gift to our children so that they can become so much more than we are.
That's beautiful. I think that's certainly something that I enjoy hearing today and something I've been thinking a lot about myself. And just in regards to my own, as I'm the processor that I am, that is beautiful. I love that. To all the crones out there listening today, I know you join me in thanking Esther for joining us today. Her contact information will be in the show notes. It has been an absolute honor to get you out of your busy schedule for an hour to chat with us. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. Let me tell you one more thing here, because it's after menopause. So in Japan, there is no word for hot flashes.
Oh, wow.
They don't have them, okay? Because women there are really revered after menopause. It is after menopause that our energy no longer goes down to the earth, but rises up to the heavens for our creativity to rise. And all throughout history, it's postmenopausal women who have had the greatest impact on culture.
That does not surprise me.
Right. And so that's really what I want to gift everyone with, is that knowing that, yes, our energy now is freed up to really become our greatest creative selves.
I've certainly started to experience that. My life feels like creativity. My creative life didn't really begin until it really jumped and flew off the rails when I turned 60. So that, I concur. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I just want to invite people to check out my website, become a part of our newsletters. And we do all kinds of workshops and dissemination of information. And I love to create a much bigger circle and net so we can be the influencers.
And that's also on your, so people go to your website, they can sign up right there.
Right.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Esther. I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day in your beautiful nature area. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you for listening to today's conversation. I'm always on the lookout for inspiring and fascinating women over 50 to spotlight on the Women Words Wisdom podcast. If you believe you or someone you know would be a great candidate, please visit the podcast page of ourstoriestoday.com to learn more. You can find the link in the show notes.